Thanks. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be back here. I forgot how nice things can be, and I'm still hitting myself for the fact that during the 5 years when I was here, I didn't take a hike every day or every other day. It just seems... anyway, so this is work which has been going on in Saclay for quite a few years. My collaborators are here. Those in blue are going to be in the market this fall. So if you see their names among the 500 applicants, you'll get, you know, remember, this guy has funny A's and O's and stuff. So you know, he'll be easy to, he always stands out. So I'll begin very quickly by doing some recap of some old work. Essentially, I'm talking, if you look at metastable vacuum engaged theories, this is some old result by Intelligator Cyberger and Shi, who showed that in any Cauchon super QCD, you can build metastable vacuum, metastable vacuum exists. And then, again, this will generalize to many, many other theories. However, if you try to realize this metastable vacuum in type 2A as brain engineering constructions, you find that this cannot happen. And you can ask why. You can ask, why can't you embed the field theory metastable vacuum found by ISS into type 2A brain constructions? And the reason is quite interesting. So the way you engineer N equals 1 gauge theories in type 2A is by taking some NS5 brains and taking some D4 brains between them. And then, you know, this is stuff which is, you know, old and is very well known. The D4 brain ends inside the NS5 brain on a codimension 2 line. As a result, the end of the D4 brains source some modes on the NS5 brain, which are logarithmic modes. And those long modes were shown by Witten ages ago to cause the NS5 brains to bend. Now, this bending is very important because if you look at the bending of these brains, the length of this brain here and here is different. And this bending actually encodes, you can convince yourself very easily, encodes the running of the coupling constant of the N equals 1 gauge theory. So it's very important. This bending is a very important feature of the physics and essentially encodes the log running of the N equals 1 coupling constant. Four-dimensional gauge theories have whose coupling constants run, they run like a log. And then if you try to build up these metastable brain constructions, if you try to embed them in string theory as brain constructions, you find that you have something which looks supersymmetric, something which is a metastable configuration, but they differ by a tiny, tiny infrared perturbation. But because you have this log there, the moment your perturbation in the infrared, as tiny as it be, touches this log, this actually goes and screws up the ultraviolet. This log doesn't die at infinity. It actually propagates and basically becomes large when you go to infinity. And therefore, what appears to be two vacua of the same theory, in fact, are not. Once you look at this log, once you look at the back reaction of these fields, once you take it into account, you find that basically two configurations which look the same in the probe approximation, if you look at the way they talk to this log, you find that they're not the same. Now, this is nice and beautiful, and it's all about type 2A brain construction. This is stuff which we did, you know, 10 years ago before I went to France. Now the question is, okay, what about some other systems where we have N equals 1 gauge theories and possible metastable vacua? And in particular, can we get metastable vacua in ADS-CFT, more precisely in Klebanov-Strassler? Those of you who don't know Klebanov-Strassler, this is just some geometry which looks like, again, when you have ADS5 plus S5, instead of having S5, you get something called T11, which has a 3-sphere times a 2-sphere, and then you blow up the 3-sphere at the bottom, which this is called a deformed conifold. And this solution, you can put in the solution fluxes. You can put an H3 flux on some open 3-cycle, and you can put some F3 flux on the other cycle. And as a result, these fluxes source for you D3 brain charge in the fluxes. And this is, again, a supersymmetric solution that is known and loved by many people for many years. Now, if you put some anti-D3 brains at the bottom of this solution, anti-D3 brains have opposite charge to the fluxes. If you had brains and anti-brains, they would immediately annihilate. But when you put anti-D3 brains, you can actually argue that those anti-D3 brains don't die immediately. They actually annihilate against this charge only by tunneling. And you end up with something which basically is a BPS solution with less flux here. So you end up with a solution which has less charge in the fluxes. And so this would be the supersymmetric vacuum. And the metastable vacuum would be the one which has more charge here and then anti-D3 brains at the bottom. So this is something which is known for, again, which has been argued many, many years by Kartrup, Peterson, and Berlinde, and also by Maldacena and Nastassi for a similar system. So again, if you just look at the probe and you ignore the back reaction of these objects on the solution, you get something which looks like a metastable configuration. Now, the big question is the anti-D3 brain in KS really metastable? And why are we asking this question? Why are we trying to unbury the dead? Well, in Klebanov-Strassler, much like in this type 2A brain construction, you have logarithmic fields. There's a field in Klebanov-Strassler, which is the integral of B2 on the S2, which encodes the difference of the running of the two coupling constants of the Kuiper gauge theory. And this integral goes like log of R. And it should. Again, it's a dual to a four-dimensional gauge theory. There should be a field there going like a log. And when you put entity-3 brains at the bottom of Klebanov-Strassler, the entity-3 brains do couple to this field. It's very easy to see that entity-3 brains have some F5, and there's a non-trivial F3, and they talk to this B2 as a result. That's something, we can see it in half a minute. And therefore, if I'm just to blindly extrapolate my type 2A intuition, which is, again, based on a serious calculation we did with Nati Seiberg and David Shi and Simeon Hellerman and Eli Gorbatov, if I'm just to take this type 2A intuition and to project it to Klebanov-Strassler, just expanding my intuition, I would conclude that the metastability is an artifact of the probe approximation. And once I look at the back reaction of my anti-brains is going to touch this log, is going to mess up this log, and therefore is going to give rise to strong effects at infinity or to non-normalizable modes, and therefore anti-D3 brains are not going to be metastable. That's the motivation of our work. This is how we got to study entity-3 brains in KS. It was not just one morning I woke up and started doing that in France over a nice bagel. It's something which, over a nice croissant, sorry. It's something which came because of this intuition. So again, in type 2A, we showed that because you have log modes, you break supersymmetry, make metastable vacua, you get the wrong UV. We try to show the same. We try to show the same thing here, and. And there's another question, what about other anti-brains? Again, this is just anti-D3 brains in KS. What about other anti-brains in other systems? Are they also stable or unstable or metastable? What's their physics? Now, why is this important? Well, it's because anti-brains are really the bread and butter of two different fields, which have different motivations, but you know they really have, technically, it's really, you know, they're relying on the same thing. So first of all, in string phenomenology and cosmology, you have Laxon quantifications. They spit out an ADS landscape, and then you need anti-brains to uplift the cosmological constant of this ADS vacua to get the sitter and to get inflation in string theory. So for cosmology and phenomenology, they are useful. Also, if you try to solve the black hole information paradox, what we have been learning over the past few years, in a large part due to work done here, is that you need something at the horizon. You need some structure at the horizon. Fastballs, firewalls, depending, okay, the arguments, whether the structure kills you or not, but you clearly need something at the horizon. I mean, Steve is trying to argue for something maybe less visible, but you see, you need something there. Problem is, it's very hard to put something there because the horizon is null and, you know, wants to swallow everything. And for supersymmetric black holes in string theory, we have actually been able to build such structure. We have at this point a huge number of solutions which work for supersymmetric black holes, but they're supersymmetric, they're extremal. And what you want to go away from externality, you want to go to non-supersymmetric. And at this point, the only way to build systematically solutions over solutions over solutions corresponding to black holes which are non-extremal is to put anti-brains inside some bubbling solutions. It's almost identical to this KPV calculation. Okay, it's a bit more complicated because you have a few more charges, but essentially you need this kind of structure. And moreover, it was argued by Gibbons and Warner that if you want to get any solution which is not time dependent and which has, you know, large low curvature where you can do, you know, actual calculations and, you know, have some control, you must have such kind of structure of the kind which we find. So somehow we see anti-brains coming as, you know, really important building blocks in these two different fields of physics, and it's very important to understand. And again, what's their physics, and, you know, can they help us or not? Now, in string cosmology, just to give you a bit of a recap, if you don't remember from the good old times, when you compactify string theory, you get ADS. This is just some Calabi-Yau compactification, and I put this as a region of high warping. I put it in some more schematically, and the whole idea is, you know, you take some long Klebanov-Strassler-like throats, which end up with a smooth cap. And if I put some anti-D3 brains there, there's a big redshift, and this gives me an uplift of the vacuum energy by a very small amount. You need this for a small amount. If you uplift with a big amount, you're going to completely destabilize the Kähler modulus. The Kähler modulus is stabilized by some quantum corrections. Unless you put a very small amount, you'll completely mess up the stabilization. And this was again argued by KKLT to give you a small uplift of the kind you need for cosmology. And again, this is the formula, this is the potential, and those are all the contributions for the potential. And this is the term which comes from the uplift, and it was put to be over 10 to the minus 9. Again, it's a very small number. You need to put the anti-brains down some long throat. However, if the entity three brains, on the other hand, are non-normalizable, if they are sourcing modes which don't die at infinity, their effects are going to be visible all the way up to the place where you glue this Klebanov-Strassmann throat to the Calabi-Yau, and therefore their energy is not going to be tunably small. If you make this throat 10 times longer, these guys are going to stay here. They will actually not die away. You cannot redshift them away. And therefore, therefore their effect is not going to give you something of order 10 to the minus 9, but something of order 1, and that's going to completely destabilize your moduli. And we call this again scapezilla, because essentially there's a landscape of the sitter vacuum obtained by uplifting with antibrains, and essentially this is going to be the landscape zilla. Now, okay, you may say this is just Klebanov-Strasser, this is just some particular solutions, but the point is all the four-dimensional N=1 gauge theories have log runnings. And therefore, if you want to get any throat which is long enough to give you some warping, to give you a small uplift, this throat needs to be dual to some sort of gauge theory. Again, you get some whatever throat you get in your compactification, if you want the throat to be long enough, it will look ADS for a while, and therefore it will be dual to some N=1 gauge theory. That gauge theory has a cap, and therefore it's confining, therefore has running coupling constant. Because the running coupling constant is going to be logarithmic, then you'll actually, this entity three brain which you put in this throat is going to touch the log mode and it's going to change the non-normalizable modes. So essentially this phenomenon which we're finding for Klebanov-Strassler and in some very particular corner of solutions, I think it's going to be generic. Again, any long throat which confines has to have logarithmic modes in it, and once you have them, everything is dead. There'll be similar things also for D7, and because there are many examples of D7 uplift which have entity three brains on their word volume. I mean, you can catch entity three brains, you can hide them in many, many places, but at the end of the day, they'll be there. So the whole point, if entity three brains turn out to be bad, is that essentially string theory will have a landscape of ADS vacua, but this landscape will not become a landscape of DS vacua. You'll not be able to obtain a landscape of DS vacua, and that's again why the name scapezilla. And those of you who like pictures, that's the picture. This is supposed to be some multiverse. That's what I could find on Google Images about multiverse. So the whole this guy comes and hopefully eats it all. Now,
Yosef, if I'm a little bit confused.
Yes.
You put an actually entity three brain.
Yes.
That has roughly the same quantum numbers of an N=4 Young's theory, so that shouldn't mess up the coupling.
No,
because
of course.
An N=4.
You put it down. The problem is you have to put entity three brains down a very long throat.
No, what I'm trying to understand is why you say that we modify the beta functions when what you're adding is something which is essentially has the same matter multiplied as N=4 Young's.
Because in these particular throats, the beta function runs because essentially, okay, so in Klebanov-Strasser, that's the easiest place to see, the beta function runs because essentially the charge of the solution grows logarithmically. There's integral of B.
Yeah, but it usually goes like the number of left brains minus anti-brains, and it only measures the difference. If you put a point like brain in the bulk, that difference doesn't change. So I don't understand how you actually modify the beta functions. The point is that the three brain doesn't couple to the dilaton, so It's not the dilaton.
It's coming to the B field. So it's the integral of the B field on the two cycle, which is the 1 over G1 minus 1 over G2 in Klebanov-Strasser is given by the integral of the B2. You have two coupling constants. You have G1 and you have G2. You have two gauge groups. It's a quiver theory.
Is your anti-D3 brain point-like, or is it extended?
No, it's point-like. It's point-like.
And I don't understand how it couples to...
Again, in Klebanov, it's very easy. In Klebanov-Strasser, where is it? Here. Next slide. So in Klebanov-Strasser, you have two gauge groups, G1 and G2. The sum, 1 over G1 squared plus 1 over G2 squared, is equal to the dilaton, and that actually stays frozen. The difference between the gauge group is given by the integral of the B field on the S2.
But I thought that were only like the difference of the two gauge groups.
Yes, but that's a logarithmic growth.
The point is that if you add one and one to each one of the two groups.
No, but I'm not adding it to the groups. I'm adding it in the bulk.
Yeah, but you're adding an entity brain to the bulk. That's the same thing as changing n prime to n-1 n prime-1.
Yes.
Okay. So the difference of n's, which is the thing that controls the...
So what I'm claiming is that this is not equal. So if entity brains are metastable, what you say is correct. Adding one entity brain would be the same as adding, subtracting one from each rank of the gauge group and so on. But this is not what's happening. So if you look at the solution, there's an integral of B2, which is logarithmic. Now, once you put the anti-D-brain at the bottom of the solution, the anti-D-brain couples to F5. Klebanov-Strassle and all these backgrounds has an integral of F3 on the 3 cycle. And then in the type 2B supergravity equation of motion, when you have an F5 which has the wrong sign, because in Klebanov-Strassle you have some F5 which is up because you have positive charge in the fluxes, the anti-D-brain has an F5 which is down. It's a negative brain. F5 being down couples to F3 and sources for your B field, which actually doesn't grow like log R. It actually starts going down first, and then hopefully it comes up, possibly. But by the time it comes up, it has already changed by quite a bit, and you'll see that this at infinity. It's very simple. These logs are sometimes can be annoyingly counterintuitive. The best example in my experience is to just solve the wave equation. Just take a box, take a membrane in two dimensions, an infinite membrane, and try to pinch it. You cannot do it. An infinite membrane in two dimensions, if you want to pinch it and to solve the wave equation, you cannot. I mean, the wave equation has a solution which is a log, and if you pinch it, you'll scrub the infinity, or a solution which is a constant. So if you pinch it, you have to lift up the whole membrane by the amount you pinch.
And what do you mean by pinching? You mean
so just take a two-dimensional infinite membrane, yeah, and try to raise the point in the middle by 1 millimeter. You cannot do it. I mean, there are no solutions of the wave equation. Of course, I mean, in physics, you have.
Of course, there are. Sorry, what did you say?
Solve the the Laplacian or the delta function source in two dimensions.
Yeah, there's no static solution.
Yes, of course, no, but then the solution, yeah, but here I'm trying to get static, so.
Okay.
No, hopefully. Okay, so can we find this thing? So this is again the intuition, this is again the motivation, I have all these log mods and so on. Can we actually find, this scapezilla? Of course, if you try to do it, brute force, but I think at some point you'll have to do that, but, for now, the easiest way to do is to actually, rather than starting from D3 brains, which are localized at the bottom, which gives me a cohomogeneity to GR solution, which has log mods, which my numerical GR friends wouldn't touch with the 10-foot pole. If you smear the solution at the bottom of KS, then you can actually get a solution which has some isometry, and where everything depends on one variable. So you can do as a first step in the game, you can actually find a solution which depends on a single variable, which corresponds to smeared anti-D3 brains. And that's still a painful solution because you have 8 modes, which are possible in Klebanov-Strassler, second order nonlinear equations, 16 constants, but we solve them all. I mean, we basically solve them, and we have some very smart grad students and postdocs in Saclay, and Stefano Massa is one of them, and essentially, we did all this shebang. We found all the solutions of Klebanov-Strassler, and then we found something very weird. We found that if you want the solution to correspond to anti-D brains, if you want the solution to it's a much simpler thing. If you want the solution just to attract probe D3 brains, then it must have a singularity in the infrared. Essentially, if you do all this calculation and you find that if you want to have a solution which has any chance of describing anti-D brains, it must have a singularity. And then if you do other anti-brains, again we did it for there's an M2 version of KS, there's an M3 version of KS called the CGLP solution, and then again probes. I mean, you can do the same story, and if you find back reaction, you find a singularity. There are some systems which have anti-D6s and D6 brain in flux. There's a system again called there's a solution with an A8 manifold which Andrea solved when she was a grad student, and there are many examples of anti-D brains, and all of them have a singularity. So essentially, the singularity seems to be a universal feature of all the anti-D brain solutions. It's not only about the anti-D brains in Klebanov-Strassler. And the question is then, what's the physics of the singularity? Is the singularity physical or not? Now, of course, in Santa Barbara, one thing which I learned quite a lot is that singularities, if you just see singularity, you should not accept it and embrace it with blind eyes, because you can actually imply that you either have the wrong physics or you have the wrong system. So the question is, if the singularity is physical, then life is beautiful, and the D3 brains are normalizable, KKLT uplifting works, you can do metastable, you can construct metastable fastballs and firewalls, life is beautiful. If the singularity is unphysical, and you should reject it, I mean, if one really finds arguments to reject the singularity completely, to say this singularity is bad and one should never accept it, then essentially what we are showing is that the only physical solution with anti-D3 brains in Klebanov-Strassler is actually anti-Klebanov-Strassler. What do I mean? You can have Klebanov-Strassler supersymmetric with supersymmetric D3 brains at the bottom. That's a good solution. You can have anti-Klebanov-Strassler with anti-D3 brains at the bottom. That's also a good solution. Again, both are supersymmetric, but just with different killing spinners. And you can never have a solution which has anti-D3 brains at the bottom and flux in the bulk. That's basically what would be the implication of the fact that the singularity is unphysical. This is quite preposterous. Again, if you think about it, essentially you have a huge throat which has positive charge, and I'm arguing that you cannot put charge at the bottom. So, you know, the first reaction we got when we wrote our paper back in 2009 is that, you know, what you guys are saying, it doesn't, you know, it's too preposterous and, you know, too hard to accept, and it must be physical. But again, this has turned out to be, you know, proof by wishful thinking. I mean, it would be nice that, you know, life could be like that, but, you know, somehow if you just start doing calculations and digging, you know, it doesn't look to be the case. So, what are the reasons we have to accept the singularity? Again, when we published the paper back in 2009, 2010, you know, all these years, people have been telling us that, you know, we really are, we have all these non-normalizable modes, but in principle, what you can do, we can look at a solution which doesn't have non-normalizable modes, and we'll get something in the infrared which will have some singularity, and we should just accept it because we should accept it. But this is not what you do in physics. You know, in physics, when you, if you want to do nice ADACFT correctly, you should not force at infinity only to have normalizable modes, and then accept whatever happens in the infrared. Because if you get the wrong infrared, you get the wrong physics. So, for example, you know, if you do ADS-QCD or ADS-CMT when you have a black hole in the bulk, and you don't put incoming boundary conditions at the black hole, you get the wrong physics. You know, you cannot just fix up your UV the way you want, and then, you know, just ask for the infrared to satisfy your wishes. This doesn't work. You should put the right physics in the infrared, and only the correct physics in the infrared gives you the right physics in the UV theory. Or like, if, for example, if you do Clebaron sampling, you know, it's just the wrong, boundary condition. You start with the wrong fields, and you get garbage in the infrared. And, you know, one should not look at that. So, again, the first argument against the singularity, that we should just eliminate it by playing with the modes at infinity. This is just incorrect ADACFT. But there's another proposal once about our singularity that, you know, essentially found it if you do by doing first order back reaction. So we took Clebanov-Strassler, we did perturbation. I mean, we solved the huge system of equations, but we solved it in the first order back reaction in the number of NDD brains. And then there's a hope that when you do a full back reaction, it will go away. It will somehow vanish when you look at the full back reaction. It doesn't. Again, it took us a year to prove. I mean, we really did end up solving, like, you know, many, you know, eight coupled equations, you know, non-linearly from the infrared and so on and so forth. It doesn't go away. So the singularity is there to stay. We got an argument after the paper was published, which actually, for a long time, we bought it. And it was an argument which is very nice. This singularity, if you look in the infrared, it has an energy density which blows up, but the action is finite. You know, basically, the R is blowing up, but square root of G times R is actually finite. And therefore, if you look at the integral of the energy, if you look at the action, it's finite. And since ADACFT relates finite actions and finite actions, you could argue that, you know, because I have finite actions on both sides, you know, maybe I should accept the singularity because its action is finite. And this is what Igor Klebanov told us. And, you know, and again, we went around giving, you know, talks and so on, saying, maybe that's telling us to accept the singularity. But then at some point, I think Michal Magi came to Santa Barbara, and if you guys were here, but, you know, he told me that essentially Gary Horowitz just completely fry-grilled him, telling him that look, you know, singularities should not be accepted because they have a finite energy density, a finite action, and in particular negative Marsh Schwarzschild, which again should be thrown away if any physics is to make sense. Negative Marsh Schwarzschild, you know, has finite energy density, has the divergent energy density and finite action. So accepting singularities just because your action is finite is just the wrong thing to do. And again, I talked to some other GR people, and, you know, when I was in Cambridge and so on, and, you know, essentially they just want to strangle you and to eat your body. I mean, it's just, you know, this is a big no-no. I mean, I don't know, Don, how you feel about it, but, you know, it's basically people, I mean, all the GR people with whom I talked about, and I mentioned this to them, I mean, they just said, you know, if you do that. Okay, so we should not accept the singularity just the way it is. But then maybe the singularity indicates some new physics. Maybe it indicates some new degrees of freedom. You know, when I get some singularities in many systems, there's something which the brains want to do, and I'm just throwing away that physics. And if I just look at the physics carefully, maybe I'll find some ways to resolve the singularity. And it can imply, again, some ignored degrees of freedom, some polarization. And we know that brain polarization in Clebanov-Strassler is clearly going to be an important ingredient. Why do we know that? Essentially, this was shown, you know, Kutcher-Pearson and Verlinde, even in the probe approximation, they found that these NTD brains want to polarize. And maybe the singularity of the NTD T brains means that, you know, they really want to polarize into some NS5 brains, wrapping some two-sphere here, or maybe they want to polarize in some object here, or maybe they want to do something. So it's clearly important to analyze brain polarization in this setup to understand whether brain polarization can actually save our lives. Fortunately, brain polarization in the system is quite easy. If you look at the NS5 brains at the top of at the north pole of Klebanov's thruster, this region has some ADS5 process 5 throat. So the brain polarization problem was solved by Joe and Matt's thruster, and also by Zamora in a more complicated system. This is just Polchinski's thruster in one slide. Hopefully, all of Joe's grad students should know that. Otherwise, you should not get a PhD from here. You know, that's part of the requirement. I don't know if it's still a requirement. Back in my time, it was. So, essentially, what's happening? You have some brains. They store some ADS throat, and then you have some fields, some F3 and some H3 coming in. In Klebanov's thruster, you can think about you have an ADS throat at the north pole of Klebanov's thruster, and then you have some bulk fields, some fields from the solution coming in this throat. But this can also be done just purely in the language of ADS CFT. You have some ADS5 process 5 perturbed with some three forms. Those three forms, they give rise to some Fermion mass deformation of n equals 4 super angles. And if you look at the supergravity equations of motion, those three forms, they evolve. I mean, you turn them on at infinity and they come in the infrared. And they pull out of the vacuum for you D5 brains and NS5 brains into various orientations. They can pull out a D5 in one plane or an NS5 in some other plane or some oblique brains. So they really can do a lot of stuff. They really give you many, many solutions. And there's a potential for this polarization for a certain brain. And the potential has a very universal form. It looks like R to some power 4. I put tau here because tau is what appears in Klebanov's thruster. R to the power 4 divided by the number of D3 brains. It's important that the number of brains here appears in the denominator. The more D brains you have, the easier it is to polarize. There's a reason for that. Once you put D3s and D5s, the mass is square root of N3 squared plus N5 squared. And when you Taylor expand, the more D brains you have, the lighter the shell it is. So there's a term here which again goes like one over the number of the D3 brains. There's another term in this potential which really gives you the force which the forms exert on your brain shell to polarize. And there's another term in the potential which looks like n times the radius squared. And this term is more subtle. It comes from the back reaction of these three forms on the metric and on the dilaton and on the phi form. You just compute it and so on. In Polchinski's thruster, they didn't need to do this term. I mean, they basically found this term by supersymmetry. It's n equals 1 star, and you know, it's just, you know, smart guesses, and you know, and they found this term by just invoking supersymmetry. You can also compute it the hard way by doing back reaction. This was done by Friedman and Minahan, and you know, it's really a paper which I'm still going through it. I mean, it's a paper which I'm still being amazed at how you know, the volume of the calculation and how complicated the calculation was. It was also done by Marika Taylor in some other example. But the point is, you know, this term can be computed in two ways, either by invoking supersymmetry when you have it, or by doing, you know, full back reaction. For M2 brains in ADS4 cross S7, there's a similar story. The M2 brains in ADS4 cross S7, instead of they polarize into M5s, again wrapping this funny directions, and there the potential also has a universal form. It's just the powers are different because you have a 3-sphere, so these powers are 6, 4, and 2, as opposed to 4, 3, and 2. Again, when you have supersymmetry, this was computed. That's one of the papers I wrote when I was a grad student here. You can argue that, you know, again, these brains polarize into shells and so on. If you back react those guys, you get the LLM geometries. So those of you who are familiar with LLM geometries, giant gravitons and stuff, they really come. So if you back react these geometries, they really become a limit of the LLM geometries when the giant gravitons are near the equator, and you know, when you zoom on the near equator sphere and dualize a few times. So, and the key point which I want to emphasize is that this particular term in the brain polarization potential, both here and here, this term actually doesn't care at all about how many dipole brains you have. So if you just ignore brain polarization and you just look at the back reaction of these guys, and on the dilaton and on the metric, you find these terms. So, and this term really gives you the Coulomb branch potential of the brains. This term really gives you the fact that those brains want to attract each other or want to fly apart from each other. So this last term, again, it's independent of how many of what the dipole charges are, and it's independent on all these details. This is a universal term which just tells you the brain potential in these systems. So that's again Polchinski's thruster in one slide. I hope it is okay. So now the point is, okay, well, I have this understanding that, you know, again, near the North Pole, again, my brains will source some Polchinski's thruster. So then I can ask, can I actually use this Polchinski's thruster intuition and this Polchinski's thruster calculations to understand how my singularity would be resolved? And then we did a very sneaky trick. We basically have the solution for the anti-M2 brains. I'll do the anti-M2 brains first because it's easier. And then I'll do the anti-D3 brains. We have the solutions for the anti-M2 brains who are smeared. There's a solution we found. It depends on one variable. It's a painful solution. Again, 10 functions of one variable, second order equations, you know, just solved in some horrible expansion, and so on. We have the solution. That solution depends on two parameters, which we call BF and BK. They're embedded in, everything depends on them, but here I just have things schematically. In that solution, I can compute the potential for this smeared brains to polarize into a shell of M5 brains, wrapping this shrinking S3 of the CGLP. This is again like Lebesgue-Strasser, but it's just one dimension higher, into this blue shell. If I compute this potential, I find that the potential has r to the 6, r to the 4, r squared, and this potential is really the sum of a square, which would be somehow a supersymmetric term, and something which is an L equals 2 mode, which is basically breaking supersymmetry. And I can just compute these numbers, explicitly, and then I take these numbers and I write them like this. But then you can show that when the brains back react, their brain polarization potential doesn't depend on where the brains are. And this is a very nice thing in Bochinski-Strasser. This is actually shown that essentially the polarization potential doesn't depend on whether the brains stay at some, whether the rest of the brains stay at some point, or they're smeared, or they go in some distance. This polarization potential is independent. Is independent on the location of the brains which source the geometry. And therefore, this something which I'm computing in the smeared solution is the same as the polarization potential for localized anti-M2 brains at the North Pole. This is the first thing which we did. And therefore, and then we know that, again, these polarization potentials always have two parts. There's the Suzy part, which is, again, this perfect square. And there's an L equals 2 part, which, again, is a harmonic of, which is a harmonic in the transverse space. And this allows you immediately to find the polarization potential for these M2 brains into this red channel, which is, again, the transverse channel of this polarization. And it's basically it's the same perfect square in a different variable, but then instead of having minus this, you have plus this. So you just have to switch the sign of this particular combination, and you find a new potential, again, this, which describes the polarization in this red channel. Now, in the red channel, we found these parameters, and again, everything depends. I have two parameters which I have not fixed, which depend a lot on the gluing of this thing to Clebsch-Strasser and so on and so forth. I have two parameters which I have not fixed, which I'm calling here B1 and B2. And what happened was that, this number came out of, again, this horrible calculation with this sneaky tricks done and so on and so forth. This number A2, which determines the brain-brain potential, came out to be minus some quantity times the perfect square. Now, for us, this was quite shocking because, again, we did a very complicated calculation, again, depending on two variables. This could have come either, positive all the time or negative all the time, or, maybe positive for some parameters and negative for some other parameters. It came to be a perfect square with a minus sign in front. And that's something which took us, again, we didn't expect it at all. It was completely, it was just something which, there's no way to expect it. There's no symmetry argument, no nothing. It just ends up to be a perfect square depending on these parameters. And therefore, again, the conclusion is that if you look at anti-M2 brains in this particular background, they repel each other. There's a tachyon on the anti-M2 brain. In water volume, the anti-M2 brains want to run away from each other because of the transverse fields and so on and so forth. So anti-M2 brains placed in this background, they are not going to be metastable or flat. They really have a brain-brain repelling tachyon, which again forces them to run away from each other if you try to put them localized. That's the result, again, of this calculation. And again, I want to emphasize, this is not something which was, it could have come in either way. And I was bracing, when I did this calculation, I was bracing for long numerics. I thought it would be some function of those guys, and then I have to do the matching, and then I have to find those guys by doing the full solution. I really had, I was expecting a half a year of pain, and came out to be a perfect square with a minus sign. So, essentially, it really says that, the system of anti-brains in this background, they really want to be tachyonic. There's no way, you cannot play with the modes, you cannot play with the non-normalizable modes, you cannot play with the physics a bit to kill this tachyon. You cannot. If you play a bit, you make it from here. Maybe if you hit the right value where those guys cancel, you'll make it flat. But even then, there'll be problems. Now, this is a story about anti-M2 brains. What about anti-D3 brains? Well, in anti-D3 brains, the story is a bit more complicated because anti-D3 brains, essentially, again, you can look at the polarization potential of the anti-D3 brains into D5s wrapping the contractible S2 of Clebsch-Strasser.
I'm sorry. Yes. You said there was some repulsive effect between these guys.
Yes.
Is that the end of the story? What is that?
I'll come to it in a second. Yes. So, but again, so this is something which was completely unexpected. People are saying that anti-brain should have a gap, and the spectrum should be gapped, and intuitively anti-brains attract, there's a flux around. So people are believing that anti-brains attract the flux, and therefore they get screened, and therefore other anti-brains get attracted by the solution. You know, normally when you have two objects which have charge and mass, you don't want them to repel each other. When they repel each other, somehow tells you that, you know, the charge is bigger than the mass, and that's not very happy. You know, if I give you a solution and, you know, I give you two objects of the same kind, and they repel each other, it means that, you know, their charge, I mean, if they are flat, the charge and mass are the same, and, you know, but if they repel each other, somehow the charge is more than the mass, and you don't want that.
Why don't you want that?
Well, I mean, in string theory, I mean, you know, for black holes, it's horrible. You know, you don't want charge more charge than mass. I mean, for me, it's, you know, when you put a black hole, you know, the black hole, if you put more charge than mass on a black hole, I mean, does it, I mean, it kills all the BPS bounds and all the...
But what's wrong with it in this context? You just got these guys, and in this background, you're saying they like to repel each other a bit.
Mm-hmm. That's the question, is it a bit or not? At this point, the only calculation I have is that they repel each other. I don't know anything else. But the point is, there's a proposal that, you know, when you calm them, they calm, they polarize, and so on and so forth. I just showed that that proposal is invalid. Because again, people are saying that, you know, there'll be a metastable vacuum, and so on and so forth, but nobody calculated this particular term. And, you know, here we calculated, and it came to be negative. So
how does showing that there's a repulsion between the D2s mean that mean that they don't polarize?
I'll show you in a second. I have a slide on that. So let me do first Polchinski Strasser just to get, you know, to get the same story for D3 brains. For D3 brains, the story was a bit more subtle because, again, the solution depends, again, on two particular functions. But the potential in Polchinski Strasser has actually three contributions. There's a supersymmetric fermion mass. There is a Gegina mass, M prime, which comes from the 0.3 fluxes. So, you know, you can think about this is just 2.1 perturbations. This is 0.3. They both give a mass to the fields on the antibrain. One of them is supersymmetric. The other one is a Gegina mass. Plus, there are two helicals two modes. And there are two modes which are basically harmonics of SL6, which could be there by symmetry and, you know, which have some coefficients. So, in principle, the potential depends on all these parameters. So, it's not enough. It's not enough to compute the potential to polarize in this direction. You also need to, so again, we're trying to find this potential, we're trying to find the potential to polarize on the red sphere. On the blue sphere, I can compute the potential, but the potential on the blue sphere is not enough to give me the potential on the red sphere. I need to know also the ratio of those two guys. I need to know another quantity. But to find this quantity, so again, we found the potential on the blue sphere, we got some number which depends on these parameters, and then we found the ratio of 0.3 and 2.1 fluxes. Again, we got some other funny combination of these numbers. And then we plugged everything in the Polchinski-Strasser formula, which was again found in rederived in Zamora in a more general example. So we plugged everything, we plugged all these contributions, and out came that this particular parameter A2, which again gives me the polarization potential along the bottom of the sphere, is exactly zero. Again, two numbers in the game, you know, they're entering all over the place, and at the end of the day, they just canceled. And there's no symmetry. Again, for anti-M2 brains, this guy was negative, was a minus a perfect square. So this is not a matter of symmetry. There's no symmetry which forces this guy to be exactly zero. It just came out of calculation. If you ask me why, I have no idea. It really came out of, you know, we have these solutions which depend on two variables. I mean, I have like, you know, eight functions which I'm parameterizing, I'm expanding from the infrared, you know, which depend on these guys. I'm doing regularity analysis, you know, all the slew. And I have, you know, these two parameters, everything ends up being, you know, and everything depends on these numbers. But at the end of the day, this particular parameter ends up being exactly zero. Again, don't ask me why, it just comes out. That's the result. And therefore, but then you can also argue that because the direction along this, because the polarization potential along this direction is actually flat, by generic arguments, there will be an imaginary part of this L equals two modes, which again can always be there. I mean, there's no symmetry which rules it out. And if you accept that this guy will be there, then you can show that whenever, because this guy is exactly zero, however that potential is, I mean, this imaginary part, if it's negative, you'll have a tachyon in this direction. If it's positive, you'll have a tachyon in this direction, but you'll always have a tachyon if this guy is anything but zero. So again, looks like in this particular example, because of this direction being exactly zero, there'll always be some other negative direction nearby, which will be tachyonic. So again, same story, anti-D3 brains, if you look in this particular regime, again, they are tachyonic, they repel each other. Now, I'm coming back to, one more thing, and then I'll come back to Don's question. So at least as far as the brains are concerned, I mean, the singularity which I found, it doesn't look very good. It looks like, you know, it's a tachyonic singularity. The brains want to repel each other and so on. There are some papers, actually. I mean, this is something which I'm by Gary Horowitz and also by Alex Bushell, people are doing sometimes tachyonic deformations of n equals 40 angles. And when you do tachyonic deformation of n equals 4 mL, you can do them. And then if you put a lot of temperature on the, if you make a black hole which is big enough, you can actually get a solution which is nice and decent. And in a sense, you know, if you give a negative mass to some of your fields, but then if you put temperature, you get a t squared phi squared term. And if the t squared phi squared term is big enough, that will actually help you, you know, uplift these energies and, you know, basically get a nice solution. So sometimes, for a long time, I thought that, you know, this tachyon is linked to the fact that this singularity may or may not have cloaking by a horizon, but I think now I think it's a different story. And so anyway, just as another piece in the puzzle. So again, I found that these brains have a tachyon. There's another criterion for why should one accept a singularity. This is a criterion that was spelled by Gubser many, many years ago. This good, bad, and ugly criterion that when you have a good singularity, it should be cloakable by horizon. It doesn't work all the time. There are counterexamples. I think Don has some. I mean, there are people who basically argue that, you know, there are some boo-boos in this thing and so on and so forth. But for now, that's again something which is, as a dumb string theorist who doesn't know too much about this stuff, I mean, that's something which I can try to apply. So if this criterion is okay, so again, I have this singularity, it has problems, it doesn't want to polarize, but if this criterion is okay, I should find a black hole in Klebanov-Strassler or Klebanov-Seitlin, which has negative D3 Bain charge. Again, that's something which, I mean, if this singularity is decent and it's cloaked by horizon, maybe then I haven't identified the right parameters, maybe then polarization is not the answer, maybe then something else funny happens, but at least if I can cloak it to the horizon, that would be an indication that that this solution is good. However, the black holes have been built in this play in the system, I mean, by Aharoni Buchel, Kerner, and by Buchel himself, both in Klebanov-Strassler and in Klebanov-Seitlin. Again, they have built these solutions in infinite Klebanov-Strassler. I'll come to that a bit later. And the point is, you know, just dug through their numerics. You know, they had some horrible numerics, but, you know, essentially we just went through there, and nobody had actually calculated the charge at the horizon of this black hole, but, you know, we actually took all this slew of numerics and we calculated, and what we found is that this charge is always positive. There's no way for this charge to be negative. And also there's a recent argument, which, okay, you may agree or may not agree with, that even localized black holes in Klebanov-Strassler cannot have negative charge. But there's some discussion about this, about the Pace charge versus Maxwell charge and so on. When you have an infinite Klebanov-Strassler throat, which is where Buchel's numerics are for, there you cannot even define a Pace charge. You cannot talk about a Pace charge because there's no boundary condition at infinity. To define a Pace charge, you need some... But if I do numerics, if I give you a solution, yeah, which has an infinite Klebanov-Strassler, charge is infinite, B at infinity goes like log of R, so that's infinity. How do you compute the Pace charge?
The Pace charge is,
you need the reference for the B. If I have some holographic screen at some point which says B at the holographic screen is 17, then I can compute the Pace charge. But if I have an infinite Klebanov-Strassler where B goes to infinity at infinity, and, you know, charge goes to infinity at infinity, you cannot compute the Pace charge.
It's computed. You choose some surface.
Yes.
And then the Pace charge doesn't care when you move the surface out to it.
Indeed. But the choice of that surface tells me that I can choose a surface and I can get a negative Pace charge, or I can choose another surface and I can get a positive Pace charge. But there's no way to determine for me what the surface is. I mean, what's the correct...
I don't understand the question.
So
each surface gives you an answer.
Yes. But right. Physically, what you want to understand whether this guy is negative or not. So I have a solution. I have an infinite Klebanov-Strassler solution which has a black hole.
Yeah.
So depending on how I choose my surface, I could get a positive Pace charge or a negative Pace charge. That has nothing to do with whether the brain has anti-brains or not. That's the only thing which I'm trying to say. I can define a Pace charge. If I have a holographic screen or if I glue this into some Calabiau, then I could define the Pace charge, and we can discuss more about it. I mean, it's a pretty subtle. I mean, I've been having back and forth with Joe on the email about it and so on. But the point which I'm trying to make is that, you know, if you want to use the Pace charge to identify whether the brain has negative or positive, whether the black hole is really cloaking anti-brains or not, this doesn't work for infinite Klebanov-Strassler.
I don't understand why you can't choose a surface.
Yes, I can choose it.
That would give you a certain Pace charge.
Yes.
If there were a localized brain,
mm-hmm,
and you just use the same surface in the presence of a black hole.
No, but that's the whole point. You don't have, so in the solution. So the question: how do you use the same surface? Because, you know, I have a solution which has a brain,
yeah,
and I have a solution which has the black hole.
Yeah.
How do you say what the surface is?
They have the same topology. All that matters is the topology of the surface. The Pace charge is invariant. There's two decorations.
Yes, it is. But then the question is, you know, in order to, it is invariant, but you have to tell me what the B field at the surface is. If you want to compute the Pace charge, again, if I give an infinite Klebanov-Strassler solution, and I give you a surface, you need to know what the B field of the surface is. Because the Pace charge is, you know, you need to know the value of the B field at the surface. or need to know the value of the B field somewhere, either at infinity or at the horizon or at some particular surface. And then you have to keep that fixed when doing physics. What I'm claiming is that for infinite couple of sources, this cannot be done.
No, I don't understand. The gauge charge is invariant to some issues associated with large gauge transformations. So it's well-defined.
It's well-defined, but once you tell me that's what the surface is. So what I'm claiming is that, you know, if you tell me, if I give you one surface and I tell you I'm choosing a gauge where B at the surface is minus 17, yeah. I'll get that the base charge for this solution is minus 17 or, you know, minus 18. But I can get minus 18 to have a base charge and the black hole can have positive charge. So the sign of the base charge and the sign of the black hole charge are not related to each other. So I totally agree with you that one can compute the base charge. You know, if I give you the surface and the gauge, I can compute the base charge. What I'm saying is that whatever I'm computing is a good quantity, which doesn't vary. I totally agree with you. But what I'm saying is that that quantity doesn't tell me anything about whether my black hole is really cloaking anti-brains or not.
Oh, so you agree you can tell if it contains some non-zero charge?
Yes, you're absolutely.
You're saying it's a certain way with the sign.
It cannot give me the sign. We can get into more details. I mean, if I have a finite Clebanov Strassler, if I had a holographic screen, and at the holographic screen, B is equal to 17, then it's a kosher question and you can do it. Then you can define page charge and so on. If you had somebody telling you that at the horizon, the page charge, the B field should have some value, then again, I could compute it and I could use it as a way to discriminate whether a black hole is positive or negative charged. But if I have a black hole and infinite Clebanov Strassler, there's no way to find any place. I mean, there's no way to find any information about how should I choose my B field. How should I choose my B field gauge to get meaningful information out of the page charge?
Well, I can tell you that the charge of the black hole is either minus one, a small number, or sort of n minus one.
Actually, not. For infinite Clebanov Strassler, you cannot even say that. If you have infinite Clebanov Strassler, the only thing which you can say is that, you know, you give me some value and then I can move it up. I mean, there's no way to, I mean, for infinite Clebanov Strassler, it's again for, I can get in, I mean, we can talk later, more if you want, but later. But, you know, it's really, for infinite Clebanov Strassler, you cannot even tell me that.
But if one has a top-down construction, well, has the Calabi-Yau,
then you can define it. Then it's a kosher question. Then it's a kosher question if you have a Calabi-Yau, and the Calabi-Yau you have the B field, which comes from an integral open H3. Then you find for me a nice gauge. Then I can discuss, and indeed, the page charge can be a useful thing to identify whether, you know, this black hole has negative charge or not, if you had a top-down construction and if your Clebanov Strassler had been closed. But if you have an infinite one of the type which Alex Buschel gets from numerics, there you cannot do it. There it's impossible to use. I mean, you can calculate it, but it's just going to be a quantity which doesn't give you any information, which doesn't have any physical meaning for the infinite Clebanov. It doesn't tell you whether they have a brain or anti-brain. I'll tell you more if you want, but, you know, it's getting side. It's important, I mean, this thing about infinite versus finite Clebanov Strassler. I mean, I'll come to it a bit later. So then the question, okay, is the singularity physical or not? You know, what's the, you know, we have this problem. And the point is, you know, a priori, nobody could have predicted, you know, back in when we started this, I mean, nobody could have predicted it. There's no reason to accept it again. We have, I mean, polarization has a tachyon, the black hole has negative charge, so all these calculations could have worked against it, you know, they all work against, and there are many underlying problems, you know, the tachyon, the no cloaking, the presence of the logmos. I mean, it's really that it has all these slew of problems. So there's a Romanian proverb that, you know, if three people tell you that you're drunk, you go and take a nap. There's the Romanian version. There's a physics problem that, you know, if three calculations tell you that something doesn't work, you know, maybe it's time to give it up. And in Santa Barbara, there's a Bayesian version. If you calculate, you know, what's the chance of the uplift not working, and, you know, again, you have all these calculations, which could give you either for or against or somewhere in the middle. And it's actually, the 96 doesn't come from 1 over 2 to the power 4. It comes from 1 over 3 to the power 3. Because, you know, essentially, it's basically when you have, you know, either 4KS or, you know, either 4KKLT or, you know, somewhere in the middle or, you know, clearly anti. When I get a clearly anti, you know, it's clearly a much stronger result than, you know, yes or no. I mean, it's basically the result could have been either, you know, pro-KKLT or, you know, somewhere vaguely in between or, you know, completely negative. And, you know, it came out to be three times, you know, completely negative. So, you know, that's basically where the 96% comes from. I'll try to, you know, in the rest of the talk, I'll try to make it a bit higher. So. Now, other uplift mechanisms, again, if anti-D3 brains are bad, essentially anything which contains incarnation of anti-D3 brains, D7s with anti-D3 brains on their word volume. There are some examples by Aganagic, Bimsok, and Wafa about, you know, some Calabi-Yaus which have some flux here positive and some flux here negative. All those things which have flux anti-flux, this is just geometrically transitioned anti-D3 brains. When you have anti-D3 brains in the background, you can have a geometric transition, and they give you this flux anti-flux. So they all have anti-D3 brains in various incarnations, but it's the same problem. even some Keller uplift models, it was argued by Ruhmann and Westphal that they have flux anti-flux in F theory. So all the, at this point, I think if you go careful and you look there, I mean, I think you'll find brain anti-brain everywhere, hidden under some corner or under some rug or under some big fat machinery. But it's all there. And my feeling is that if this is not working, there'll not be too much left. Now, coming back to Don's question, is the tachyon really bad? On one hand, you say, okay, I found the tachyon, the brains want to repel each other. But for brain polarization, this doesn't have to be so bad. Because brain polarization, I told you that I have a potential r to the 4. And then I have a minus m times r cubed. Again, the field's forcing me to polarize. And then this tachyon looks like it's doing a job for me. I mean, it's basically making this guy negative. And I have another term, which is minus r squared. It looks to make my polarization even more likely. And therefore, it looks to be helping me in getting my polarization. So what's wrong about having this this tachyon? In a sense, you can think about you have a Coulomb branch and you have a Higgs branch. In the Coulomb branch, the brains can run away from each other and so on. On the Higgs branch, the fields on their one volume become non-commutative and they polarize. So in the Coulomb branch, I have a tachyon which wants to take away the brains from each other. But if I go on the Higgs branch before, if I go first on the Higgs branch and I make the brains polarize, then and this tachyon will not change life too much because I have this guy at the 4, which at some point is going to come and kill it. And indeed, if you look at spherically symmetric fluctuations, again, if you look at brains and you only look at spherically symmetric calculations, it looks to be metastable. And everything looks to be stable. I mean, this potential has a nice stable minimum. However, if you consider modes which actually squash this sphere into an ellipsoid or shift it or do stuff to it, those modes are going to actually break spherical symmetry and they actually become unstable. So you might get the sitter vacuum where, again, you have brains polarizing and so on and so forth, but you'll have an instability coming from the squashing of this NS5 brain. Now, don't ask me what's the endpoint. I'll come towards the end about the endpoint. In a sense, what you're doing, you have n equals 4 n mils, you have n d brains, you have n square scalars. You give all of them negative mass. Now, by going on the Higgs branch, you can make some of those negative masses be uplifted by basically making these guys non-commutative, but you'll not be able to uplift all of them. In the Higgs mechanism, you have one scalar, given mass, you have an r to the 4, and everything is stabilized. But when you have n squared scalars, you cannot get n squared guys here. You cannot stabilize all of them by going on a Higgs branch. That's the intuitive calculation. And I think it would be nice to do a calculation to understand how many tachyonic modes are there and so on, but I haven't done that. So again, you might get some vacua, but which have nice uplift and have polarization, but they'll all be unstable. Now, caveats. This is the calculation. We have done all these calculations in the regime, again, for Klebanov-Strassler and for long throats and so on and so forth. Now, you can say, okay, I got all these parameters which canceled and so on and so forth. How do I know that this is going to be generic? If I have some random Calabi-Yau and some random throat which has some very different topology and very different things, maybe this cancellation will not happen. Maybe I'll not have a tachyon. So that's actually something which, again, that's the only solution I have right now is Klebanov-Strassler, so that's where I could do calculations. However, the presence of or not of a tachyon, I'll argue a bit later that it actually depends on just having a very long throat with a flat bottom. That's really what's needed in order to get this tachyon. And what you need in this particular compactification, you need a long warped throat. If you don't have a long warped throat, then there's a problem. And there are arguments by Gavin Harnett and also by Jung and Schmidt and Zagerman that we can put antibrains in some other regions of space-time, and then you can cloak them. No problem. And you can put some antibrain in some region which has negative fluxes and without a long throat, and there's no problem cloaking them and so on and so forth. I'm actually discussing with Gavin right now. We're trying to do to find some model to mimic really the bottom of Klebanov-Strassler, but it's a very special place. It's not in the middle of Calabi-Yau, you can just stick antibrains there and here and there. With some luck, you can even get them metastable. But as far as uplifting is concerned, it's going to completely destabilize your stabilization of the Kähler moduli. So that's not going to be a useful thing. Now you can also put anti-D6 brains and so on and so forth in some special systems. But generically, what you need is a long throat. Now, again, the other caveat is all our calculations that are done for distinct times n much, much bigger than 1. However, this Cacho-Pearson-Verlinde probe calculation, again, they look at the probe calculation. This is done for distinct times n much, much smaller than 1. So what's wrong with that? Well, this is one question, but not so fast. Because if you look in Cacho-Pearson and Verlinde, what exactly they do? They take some D3 brains. And they actually do them. They look at the polarization into D5 brains in the S-dual of Klebanov-Strassler, and then they S-dualize their result to this regime. If you want to describe anti-D3 brains in Klebanov-Strassler, they are polarized into NS5 brains. Now, the NS5 brain, as you know from Joe's book, has a tension which goes like G string to the power minus 2. The DC brain, on the other hand, has a tensor which goes like this thing to the power minus 1. And when the DC brain is polarized into NS5 brains, you can find very easily that the polarization radius gets an extra factor of G-string in it. And it's going to go like G-string times N times the string length. And therefore, if you want to study D3 brains polarized into NS5 brains in any in the regime of parameter where you can describe them as, you know, some big fat objects and you can do some calculations, the only place to do it is to be at G-string much, much bigger than 1. If you are in the regime G-string much, much smaller than 1, there is no way to see NS5 brain polarization. There's no way to see the polarization into big fat NS5 brains. It's just not visible in that regime. So the correct regime, if you want to claim that, you know, anti-D3 brains in KS polarize into NS5 brains and so on and so forth, the correct regime to do that is the one in which we are working. It's actually KPV which do an extrapolation. They work in the S-dual of Klebanov-Strassler, they find some result, and then they extrapolate to Klebanov-Strassler. We are the ones who work in the right regime. So that's caveat number one. Everybody keeps on saying KPV is good here. It's actually not. They are working in some other regime, and then they are dualizing themselves into Klebanov-Strassler. So the right, if you want to do NS5 polarization, again, you need to have G-string much, much bigger than 1. So this is thing number one. However, you can say, okay, forget about polarization and so on and so forth. You can ask, what about, you know, a few anti-D brains? You know, can I even, okay, even if this NS5 would be very small, you can argue that, you know, a few anti-D brains make sense as probes, and therefore, if I look at their physics, you know, they interact with the bulk and so on. So Joe, Andrea, Eric, Ben, and Philip. I don't know if he's here or not. No. Okay. So basically, the Santa Barbara group, I mean, so 1 year and a bit ago, finally we got some answers. So again, for like about 3 years, everybody kept on saying, you know, entity theorems are maybe good at G-string times N much, much smaller than 1, but nobody had any proposal and any calculation. Those are just words. People are just saying, okay, your calculation is not good, but in some other regime, maybe it goes away. That maybe your tachyon goes away, maybe life becomes nice and beautiful. So finally, you know, those guys found a way to compute, you know, to actually find the effect of the brains interacting with all these fields. And there's an approach which is called the brain effective action, which, I mean, I guess you heard talks about it quite a bit. So there are basically, we can take a few anti-brains and you can actually look at the various diagrams where you have two supergravity fields interacting with the open strings on the brains. In their paper, that you don't see the string diagrams. The string diagrams are just, I mean, what they have in the paper are just the light closed string limit of this string diagrams, and you know there's a big expression, and you can calculate again the corrections to the brain potential, and you can ask, okay, are the brains tachyonic or not? You know, what's happening to their physics? Now, what we did in Saclay was to say, let's go to some limit, let's go to some low energy limit in which the brains, in which these diagrams reduce to field theory diagrams on the brain. In a sense, you can say that if you do brains in supergravity and you look at supergravity propagators and so on, you're looking at the light closed string limit, which is the one they're looking at. But there is very hard to do calculations. You know, essentially, you can estimate some terms, but you cannot calculate, you know, integral of this equals square root of 2 times that. I mean, you cannot do these calculations. If you do if you go to the open string limit, to the light open string limit, which is the one where we went, essentially, this brain effective action basically becomes the field theory on the brain. And you can actually do all these calculations and everything which you do in supergravity. For example, the back reaction of the brain on some field, this becomes on the field theory in the brain the running of the of some coupling constant with the energy. And there's a very nice story. I mean, again, whatever supergravity back reaction we get, you see it on the field theory in the brain as the running of some coupling constants. So, okay, easier said than done. This is something which started about a year ago. I mean, it's quite complicated. I mean, everybody and their brother has different conventions. When you put some anti-D brains in some fields, you get three kind of terms. You get, first of all, N equals 4 angles. Again, there's the usual, so they get the usual N equals 4 angles term, the fermion, the Yukawa coupling of N equals 4 angles. But then you get more. So first of all, the G form, again, H3 plus F3 plus IH3. So the one combination of the three forms, it gives you a non-commutative, it gives you a tri-boson coupling. It gives you phi 1, phi 2 commutator, phi 3. It gives you a commutator of the, a trilinear coupling in the bosons. That's one term which you get. And then you get some boson mass, which comes from the background fields and so on and so forth. And then you get some fermion mass, which comes from these fields. This term was found by Myers and by Taylor and Ramban Amsdong many years ago. This is what Myers, when he did the electric brains, this is the kind of term which he used. He put the D brains in some transverse field, he found this kind of coupling. So this is Myers' electric brains. This term was found by Marina Grania when she was a grad student here by doing, again, some other things. very different calculations, very different conventions. So basically, it's a nightmare to just clear up all the conventions and to get one convention to make everything work. This just comes from the brains moving around. So this is just a term which comes from the tree-level action. Point number one, if you do the conventions correctly, find that, you know, again, this S guy, which gives you the fermion mass, is linked to the G guy, which gives you the boson, trilinear. This was known for supersymmetric examples, because in a supersymmetric example, you can get this, both those guys can come from a superpotential, but it also works for non-supersymmetric examples. However, this term comes entirely from Klebanov-Strassler. And what we found, again, by looking at these conventions and doing everything correctly, is that at three level, you basically get the fermion mass, which has some mf times the sum of the psi's. In Klebanov-Strassler, because the flux is 1,2, a probe anti-D-brain only sees 2,1. So a probe anti-D-brain actually has a supersymmetric fermion masses on its word volume. And so those masses are really the same as a supersymmetric, as n equals 4 broken down to n equals 1 star. And then there's another term which can be written as, again, the supersymmetric partner of this guy. This is always going to be there. And, you know, we had a paper with Mariana and Stefano and some of our grad students and Michela Petrini, where it showed that, you know, those two guys always come with the same coefficient, the trace of the bosons and the supersymmetric mass. And then there's another term, which I'm drawing here in blue, which comes from essentially the L equals 2 modes of the problem, which comes from the Klebanov-Strassler geometry and from the conifold and from the way the conifold is curved. Those guys are universal. I mean, the red guys are universal. Whatever you put the brain, if the brain has transverse 2,1 fields, it will get exactly these two guys. This depends a lot on your location, but at the bottom of KS, it so happens that this guy has exactly the same coefficient as this guy, such that those two guys cancel. And you have a flat potential at three level. At three level, again, you have an S3 at the bottom of Klebanov-Strassler. The brain can go anywhere on the S3. The potential is flat. And therefore, this guy is massless at three level. At three level, again, you get a boson mass, which for three guys is just massless. There are three ways of getting to this potential, but OK, I'll not bother you with the results. Point is, the theory on the anti-D brains is just n equals 4 broken down to n equals 1 star by these masses, and broken down again to n equals 0 star by this blue term. That's the theory which anti-D brains on Klebanov-Strassler, which in Klebanov-Strassler has. Now, this is a theory which has no supersymmetry, so you say, okay, it's a nice theory, but, you know, it has, you know, all these Feynman diagrams and so on and so forth, and one has to compute all these Feynman diagrams. And again, if you look in the light open string limit, you know, there are some diagrams that you can compute in this brain effective action which correspond to the string theory loops. And we started to compute these loops. First of all, we did it the hard way by just looking at loops and integrals and stuff like that. But then we found some results by Jack and Jones first and then by Parks and West back from 83. And those results were basically telling us that this particular n equals 0 star theory which we have, but only this particular one, has very funny features. Essentially, its beta functions are 0 to all orders in perturbation theory. And that's a feature, again, because of this particular pattern of supersymmetry breaking. Again, normally you don't expect this. Normally you have a theory, supersymmetry is broken, you expect everybody to run, all the Feynman diagrams to be non-zero, you expect to have, you know, everything, everybody and their brother playing around. And that's, you know, the normal intuition. You know, you put some brains and some background, you know, everything happens, everybody back reacts, everybody talks to each other, there's no supersymmetry. However, anti-brains in Klebanov-Strassler, they give you a very particular n equals zero theory, and this theory was shown by Parks and West by some horrible superspace Spurian methods and so on and so forth, which I'm not even, you know, I mean, I'm not even understanding them too well. Essentially, it was shown to be finite to all orders in perturbation theory. So what's happening as a result is that if you look at the brain-brain potential along the bottom of Klebanov-Strassler in this brain effective action approach, which in the limit, again, in which we can compute it exactly, what you find is that to all orders in perturbation theory, to all loop orders, this potential along the S3 is 0. So this potential, again, between brains and brains, again, supersymmetry is broken. They should talk to each other. They should beat up each other. They should screen each other, and so on and so forth. Nothing happens. The potential remains nice and flat to all orders in perturbation theory. And then, again, coming back to this Polchinski-Strassler result, which I found, you know, 2 years ago with Mariana and Stanislav Kuperstein and Stefano Masai, there we found that the potential, again, the brain-brain potential along the S2, along the S3 at the bottom of KS is also 0 in the fully backreacted regime. So now I have two calculations, one of them at weak coupling, in which I show that to all loops, this potential is flat. And one of them at strong coupling, again, using Polchinski-Strassler and using this god-awful mess, where this potential came out to be flat, again, in the full back reaction regime. Now, hopefully, it's going to be flat in the middle, unless you have partition of unity and stuff like that, you know. But again, that's something. But anyway, in the two regimes where I could calculate, there was nothing. I mean, you know, this potential comes out to be exactly flat. And at finite intermediate G-string times n, I don't think, I mean, no. Maybe it happens, but, you know, at this point, you know, I cannot say anything. And if it's always flat, then you can actually show, based on generic arguments, that you'll always have a term which gives you a brain repelling tachyon. So essentially, in all this regime, I mean, again, in these two regimes of parameter where we could do exact calculations, you know, we could always find, you know, exact, we could always find the exact thing. So in Bayesian language, again, we have another calculation. I haven't multiplied it by 1/3 because essentially this result came out to be exactly negative. I mean, if you got a negative thing, so this is just a 2/3. I mean, I just gave it a 2/3 weight. But you know, I'm pretty sure. I mean, 2/3, I'm willing to fight for it. 1/2, it would have been a bit too much. But you know, essentially, we reduced it down from 96%. I mean, now it's actually 98% that you know the chance of all this stuff working. Again, anti-DC brains in the full back-reacted regime, we have all these calculations. Now we have this one. Again, which gave us, again, the same funny thing and the tachyon. And again, it looks like it's going down and down. Then there's a lot of intuition. The thing which I want to emphasize is that, you know, many people and many smart people, you know, much smarter than me, and they have intuition about anti-D brains, and, you know, there are papers that, you know, they get flux, there's a flux coming and it's clouding the anti-D brains, and, you know, they are gapped, and all these intuitions which people have formed, and they are normal intuition. They make sense. They assume that, you know, you have some normal theory, and, you know, in a normal theory with no supersymmetric couplings run and everything happens. Everything which can happen. And the point is, in this particular system, and, you know, this particular enterprise, this intuition is just wrong. Does not work. And it really has to do with this, you know, stupid, not the lack of, the absence of running of the coupling in this particular theory. And this is, again, Parks and West back from 83. This theory seems to be very rigid. I mean, these enterbrains seem to be very rigid. They don't want to calm the flux. Even if, you know, they have negative charge and positive mass, the flux around them has positive charge and positive mass. Gravitational attraction, electrical attraction, you want the flux, you think the flux comes and clumps? No, it doesn't. The clumping of the flux would have corresponded to a running of the mass. It doesn't. In this particular limit, it doesn't. I have no idea why. I have no idea why, but you know, this is again what the calculation shows in this particular regime of parameters. So it's something which, I mean, again, as a word of caution, it's very important to distinguish. I mean, you know, there are many arguments about brains and so on and so forth, and you know, the many intuition claims that oh, anti-brains will be good because something will happen or something will happen or something will happen. It's very important to distinguish. I mean, these intuition claims, again, for this particular system, they have always gone wrong. I mean, systematically. And again, our goalposts have been that, you know, essentially, you know, back in 2010, everybody said, oh, anti-brains are okay. I mean, this singularity will just go away. It doesn't, you know, then people said just a few antibrains will be okay. They are not. Now people are saying maybe a single one would be okay. I'll talk to that in a second. But the point is, you know, all these calculations which we have done, again, could have given answers on either side, you know, but and those are like, you know, hard calculations with equal signs. I'm not approximating anything. We have full control on the calculations. They always gave against, and they always came out to completely infirm whatever intuition people have. And actually, in my case, I'm actually a bit guilty because when KKLT appeared, you know, Shamit, I was a postdoc at UCLA, and I had done a lot of stuff on brain polarization during my PhD. So Shamit asked me, I mean, I have a message from Shamit asking me, have you ever seen, like, you know, when you have brains and so on and so forth and this polarization, have you ever seen, you know, negative R-squared terms? And I was like, no, Shamit, I've never seen those, you know, they're just weird. I mean, I don't expect them to be there and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm part of the, you know, I have the email, you know, and you know, so basically, you know, I could not believe that this happens. I could not believe that, you know, these terms in this brain polarization would become negative or would stay flat to all orders in perturbation theory with no supersymmetry around. So again, at this point, again, we have all these calculations, and all of them seem to be saying that, you know, there's a problem, there's a problem, there's a problem, and it's very important to distinguish again between what people hope to be and, you know, the stuff based on wishful thinking versus, you know, basically calculations and so on. I have this joke about, you know, U.S. dollars and Zimbabwe dollars. You know, if you don't know how much Zimbabwe dollars are, I mean, you know, essentially, that's in a sense the ratio. I think it's, you know, one of those it's a few of those. So you know, it's very important to distinguish when you can make a hard calculation. You know, essentially, and somehow, you know, these hard calculations, they have gone against the underlying intuition. Now let's come to the last thing. Again, moving on, we have been trying to get all past these moving goalposts for the past years. Now the only thing which survives is a single antibrain, because I showed you that, you know, many antibrains have a tachyon, and you know, they have this flat potential, they're not gapped and so on and so forth. But the single antibrain doesn't have a tachyon. A single antibrain, you put it at the bottom and you can put it anywhere you want, so there's a symmetry, so it shouldn't, you know, it doesn't have a tachyon, at least naively. Moreover, there's some new examples which people have started. So after we started killing all these antibrains, you know, at some point people in Stanford Oxford woke up and they started churning up again their landscape producing machinery. So the newest contraption is something by Renata and friends with nilpotent supergravities, which essentially involves putting an antibrain on top of an orienting fold. Now, those are nice, you know, that's a nice construction, and apparently it makes some sense in string theory. Personally, it makes my skin go like that, because essentially the orienting fold has negative mass and negative charge. Antibrain has negative charge and positive mass. You put them together, you get more charge than mass. For a single fundamental object in string theory, this should not happen. You know, normally you should not get more charge than mass. You know, that's basically. So for me, this is not something which, I mean, I'm trying to.
The orienting fold already has more charge than mass.
Sorry? No, the orienting fold has negative mass and negative charge, doesn't it?
The usual question is whether absolute value of the charge exceeds m with its sign. And so in that sense, the orienting fold already has more charge than mass.
Yes. But the orienting folds people are, again, with orienting folds, you know, things are supersymmetric, and you can argue that, you know, they make sense. I think if you get more charge than absolute value of the mass, that's really, that's a much more fundamental problem.
Why? What's wrong with it?
I think it disobeys various.
Like negative is mass structure.
It gets old. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
why is it worse than an orienting fold, which is negative mass? I don't see what's.
The orienting fold, I can get it. You know, at least in M theory, I can build. You know, I can build that. Yeah, Hitchin. Yeah, Hitchin. If I look at infinity and I slam a time on it, I get negative mass and negative charge. So, you know, at least I have a construction of something. But Atiyah Hitchin is, in a sense, it's a space which makes sense. I mean, the fact that I'm getting negative mass and negative charge comes really because, I don't have a...
It's topology.
It's a topology. But to get more charge than, I mean, to get the absolute value of the charge to be bigger than the absolute value of the mass, I mean, that's just, I mean...
Take Atiyah Hitchin and add some photons. Will achieve absolute value of the charge bigger than absolute value of the mass. I can't spell that.
I think there's a problem with adding photons. I mean, because of the topology, it's not. I don't know exactly. I mean, I think there are some problems.
Zero by adding photons.
Sorry.
I can make the mass zero by adding photons to the Hitchin.
But I think there's a problem with getting them to be stationary. And I mean, you know, here I'm trying to get, you know, time independent things.
Drop a small Schwarzschild black hole into the Hitchin.
Ah, but then the moment you put black holes, you're dead. Because the moment you put black holes, GTT and GXX are not the same. And then for landscape purposes, it's useless. So uplifting with black holes would have been the cheapest way. I mean, 5 years ago, I was like, you know, saying, oh, this is the cheap. Why don't people just slam a black hole there and everything would be nice and beautiful? And just put a deep brain in Clebano-Strasser, put a small black hole, and so on. Problem is, when you put a black hole, GTT is not the same as, you know, G11, G22, GT3, and this breaks Lorentz invariance. And that's going to screw up completely the cosmology.
My point is that there are plenty of solutions we can build which you could be happy with, which will have absolute value of the charge greater than the absolute value of the mass.
I don't think time independent solutions with no GTT and GRR are different. I don't think you can build them at all. Time independent. I mean, you know, I want them to be stationary. I mean, if I get them to be time independent, of course I can build them. But for these purposes, I need them to be time independent. I mean, I need the universe to be made of those.
This is fine. I didn't follow you. You had some extra worry about GTT versus GRR. That's something else. But it's not. There's no absolute rule that says it's a problem when absolute charge exceeds absolute value of mass.
I see. I don't know, for me it's kind of, I mean, I cannot cloak it. I mean, okay, the other thing is, I can, if I want to put a horizon around it, for example, I cannot, starting at small temperature. Once I put a high temperature, then of course I can get a black hole to eat up the difference, but I cannot turn off a horizon. So, I mean, I can take this object, I can put a horizon around it with a big temperature, but then if I try to lower the temperature, at some point, when the mass above extremality is going to become below some number, I'll get a naked singularity coming out. So it's a cloaking, so I can cloak this thing with a black hole, but then the moment I approach it, I cannot obtain this object in the limit of turning off a black hole.
You do it with topology, that's the point.
Right. Maybe you should finish what you want to say.
Okay. What time is it, you know?
I'm going to leave this aside.
10 minutes over.
Oh, okay, sorry. Anyway. So that's the thing. And somehow people are, you know, at this point, you know, there's a very common claim that, you know, somehow if you look at a single antibrain, you know, all these problems that we have been finding, you know, just because it's a single one, you know, all these problems are going to magically go away. Honestly, I don't think it will happen. And also there's another claim, and, you know, people hope that, you know, you have this tachyon and the brains go away from each other and they'll find some other place, you know, they'll move around and, you know, they'll stabilize, they'll settle down in some other place, you know, floating around the bottom of KS. Those are calculations. Those are, like, you know, again, intuition, and, you know, that's basically stuff which should be nice to show. But at this point, there's no hard calculation showing that. Essentially, for a single antibrain, in our limit, it's just a free theory. So, you know, there's nothing, I cannot calculate this running. The single antibrain cannot see this running in the limit in which I'm computing. In principle, if you look at the full limit, so again, we work in some light open string limit. If you look at the full limit, which Joe and his collaborators are looking at, there you could find the potential, but this potential could actually go up or down or flat. You have some terms and one should compute them. In principle, this can be done, but you know, those are calculations to be done. Again, it's also important to take into account the interaction with log modes, because you know this background has log modes that, which are going to be very light, and you know this is something which one should take into account. And also, you know, again, as far as new metastable vacuum are concerned, at this point there's one proposal, based on like you know basically hard calculations, which is KPV, we showed it's unstable, and at this point there's no other proposal. So at this point, essentially, there's nothing you know established, and again, those things are at the level more of Zimbabwe dollars. In principle, it would be nice to make them you know US dollars, you know, find a solution and so on. It can be done. It involves numerics. It involves you know a bit of pain, but in principle, you know, those can be upgraded into like you know US dollars. But you know, and you know, I think that it's important to do. But for now, I think they're not really hard calculations. I don't want to get into this. This is just you know. We do the same for non-extremal fastballs, and you know why we like them. I'll just skip this. I mean, you know, essentially the fact that you all know that we have the solutions. They have a mechanism not to fall into a black hole, and you know that's difficult to do. And you know you should not normally put stuff at the horizon, but essentially we have and one should need a support mechanism in order to get any firewalls and fastballs in string theory. And we have such a proposal, and we also have a way to avoid forming a horizon by collapsing this thing. So we have for black holes. Again, what I'm saying about antibrains, for supersymmetric black holes, you have a mechanism, again, to stay at the horizon, to avoid forming a horizon in collapse, and also to grow with G string the way, again, you want, exactly the way you want a black hole to grow. Problem is, we only have it for extremal black holes. I mean, we have done all these calculations, and we have all this structure built for extremal black holes. And the question is, what about non-extremal black holes? What's going to happen to all these things which we build when we go to non-extremal black holes? One option is that basically for non-extremal black holes, all these structures are going to stay at the inner horizon. And again, that's what can happen logically. Or the other option is that actually this structure, and you know, this is quite common and it's expected, and Don has another paper arguing that you know this will happen and so on and so forth, because this is in the future of the singularity. But somehow what we want for resolving the information paradox, you want this structure to go all the way to the outer horizon. And the only way we have it right now systematically, the only systematic way to do it is to basically build, again, to put this kind of antibrains on top of non-solutions. And again, antibrains, they seem to be the only systematic way which we have to build many, many, many non-extremal microstates. And then, you know, to argue, to ask questions, you know, do I get a shell to become those and so on and so forth. Problem is, again, those are going to be unstable. And the question is, if you have antibrains and so on and so forth, and you know, if this KZilla is going to kill all the antibrains which are used for cosmology, what is it going to do for fastballs and for firewalls and so on? Is it going to kill them also? And you know, maybe it's just going to be a nice story for supersymmetric things, and then once you go away from supersymmetry, everything is lost. So those are again my conclusions. Again, probe antibrains are good for uplifting under the sitter to the sitter, and for getting structured the non-extremal horizons. That's you know, again, those are the two useful things. If you do back-rated antibrains, there's a singularity with no horizon cloaking. That's again the result. There's a brain-brain repelling tachyon which we found in two regimes. And for a single antibrains, I think there's some calculations to be done to establish whether they are good or not. And at least until now, before this calculation is done, it looks like based on our calculations, a lot of things have to be revisited, a lot of string cosmology and so on. And again, so far it looks like there's no DS landscape based on our results. I mean, again, all these calculations, nothing which could come pro KKLT came pro KKLT. Again, that's a fact. Again, Bayesian 98% if you want to put numbers. And one should find other ways to uplift. Maybe nothing, maybe many. I don't know. And also the non-extremal fastballs, if this is correct, they look to be unstable. There are some people arguing that, you know, there's chaotic behavior when you have black holes and so on and so forth. And, you know, essentially this instability of fastballs, which may be linked to this. So I'll leave those as different things.
Way to make a single antibrain calculation into money, what would that be the string perturbation calculation?
Sorry?
What did you say?
Here or?
Yeah, you said that one can turn the arguments for the estimates that you have the single antibrain into.
And there are a few things, you know. One thing, okay. One way to do it, so again, the problem is you cannot do string calculations in Ramon-Ramon backgrounds. Now, what you can say is that, okay, I have all these charged dissolving fluxes. In Clebolov structure, charged dissolving fluxes means F3, H3, and F5. And there you cannot do string calculations. However, you can be sneaky. You can say, let's go to some other duality frame where I can actually transform my F3, H3, and F5, again, the way they play this charged dissolving fluxes game, I can transform it into metric and just H field. So, for example, if you have you have this D1D5 P system, and there, you know, there are all these fluxes and so on, which have charged dissolving fluxes. If you go to the F1 NS5 P system, there it's all NS NS fields. And there, in principle, I can do a calculation. I can say, okay, let's take some bubbling solution which has F1 and S5 and so on and so forth. I can take some F1, or I can take some other D-brain, and then I can ask, and then I can try to make this brain effective action calculations using, again, having a purely NS NS background. And that's something which may be more tractable, and that's something where I could actually make the full calculation as opposed to just, you know, doing this open string emit which I have. That's one hope. I mean, that's one hope which I have. The other hope is, you know, essentially to try to understand what these log dynamics are doing, and again, whether this Clebolov cluster throat which we have, when you put some antibrains, gets actually become very long and gets flushed into Clebolov cycling. The reason why a black hole doesn't exist is that actually, but when you have an infinite Clebolov cluster, if you put a black hole there, even a positive charged black hole, the black hole just basically collapses this S3 into Clebolov cluster, just, you know, because the deformation of the conifold is a flat parameter, and then if you put a black hole there, the black hole wants this deformation parameter to be small, so it creates a potential in the moduli space and drives into Clebolov cycling. And the question is, once you glue to a Calabi-Yau, for example, this will become stabilized, but then the question is, what's the balance between, on one hand, the Calabi-Yau stabilizing this direction, and the black hole wanted, or the anti-brain wanted to drive you to basically Clebolov cycling and complete annihilation. And that's a calculation which, in principle, one could try to do. So I've been discussing a bit with Ben and other people about how to. And so, you know, those are the kind of calculations which one can do, and, you know, in principle, you know, they'll give a result. But, you know, it would really get these calculations done, and, you know, to try to see whether a single anti-brain, you know, what happens to it, whether it still has a chance or not. Personally, I think it is doomed, but again, since I've been, but, you know, that's...
In the interest of time and cookies, maybe we should end there.